Good morning. It looks like we are ready to proceed. I just want to make sure that I can hear everyone, so I'm going to go by who's on my screen. Mr. Magnuson, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Miltich?
Good morning, Your Honor.
I can hear you. And Mr. Bayless?
Morning.
Good morning. If at any time we drop off or you can't hear us, please raise your hand so we can make sure that everyone's hearing what's going on. Madam Marshal, will you please call the case?
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Flory, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding, now calling the case of Kirkala versus City of Moorhead et al., court file number A200657.
Thank you and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The rules are going to be a little different for this argument, and I know that you have heard from our Cindy Lair. As I understand it, Kirkala will have 15 minutes and will start the argument, then the city will have 10 minutes, then the DNR will have 10 minutes, and then Kirkala will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Having said that, these proceedings are being recorded, so please state your name at the beginning of your argument. And with that, Mr. Magnuson, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor, and thank you. For the record, Eric Magnuson on behalf of the plaintiff, Freedom Kirkula. It is a little bit unusual to give a respondent's argument before the appellant has spoken, but I think we can make relatively quick work of the city's appeal. The city claims that it's entitled to the same immunity as the DNR, and since the DNR is immune, it is immune. As we say in our brief, that's an argument based on two flawed premises. First of all, as we will argue later, the DNR is not immune, but even if it is, the city's immunity flows, it is not entitled to immunity under the statute because its conduct has nothing to do with the immunity statute. It did not own, lease, or operate the recreational property. That's a distinction that the district court saw and said that its different conduct is subject to a different standard. The city has asserted that we didn't raise this issue below. If you look at document 24, which is the memorandum in opposition at page 17, you'll see that precise argument. There is no basis to find the city immune regardless of the facts or law concerning the duty of a landowner to a child. And that is what this case turns on. Now, the DNR is in a different position.
Let me ask you this. So do you think the district court was wrong in saying that in applying the general trespasser as opposed to a child trespasser standard?
Well, I think when it comes to the DNR and the particular facts of the claim against the DNR, there is a good argument that the child trespasser statute should have, or standard should have been applied. But I submit with respect to the city, it has no relevance because they're not the landowner, and the trespasser or child trespasser statutes only apply to landowners. The law is clear that under these circumstances, the city assumed a special relationship to Grace Betty to watch out for her and protect her. The evidence is more than ample for a jury to find that it breached that duty. End of discussion as far as the city is concerned. Now, the DNR did own the property and it did operate it. And so we are in the immunity statute. But with respect to the district court, the DNR wasn't entitled to a Rule 12 dismissal or to summary judgment on the facts. If you read the complaint in a light most favorable to the plaintiff and you draw all inferences in favor to her, the state could be liable in the eyes of a jury for creating and maintaining an artificial condition that was hidden from the children. Specifically, a cloudy pond with a sudden steep drop off. That's the allegation of the complaint. We have to take that as true. Now, again, the city or the DNR says that we didn't argue that it failed to warn in the complaint, that we talked all about their supervision. We did talk about their supervision, and I'll explain its relevance in a moment, but I direct the court to paragraphs 18, 36, 37C, and 38 of the complaint. Those are specific allegations that the danger was hidden and that the city or the DNR failed to warn. Now, the district court granted a motion to dismiss on the reasoning that Grace appreciated the risks of swimming as she reported she was a non-swimmer. That's from addendum 5. There are several problems with that analysis. First of all, it's a non sequitur. To infer the fact that a child is a non-swimmer and doesn't know anything about swimming, and therefore she knew the dangers of swimming, simply defies logic. More importantly, that fact about what she may have reported isn't found in the complaint anywhere. And the judge said, I'm not going to look at the extrinsic evidence. I'm only going to look at the complaint. It's not in the complaint. It comes from the police investigation where the DNR naturalist reports that at the orientation session she had for the children, she asked if anyone would be uncomfortable swimming in deep water, and Grace Betty raised her hand. Now, if you say it's okay for the court to consider that, it has to consider all of the evidence. When you look outside the complaint and you consider extrinsic evidence, Northern States Power makes it absolutely clear, you have to look at all the evidence. And what the judge overlooked is there is conflicting evidence on that point in the record. Specifically, Mackenzie Knapper was interviewed by the police. Mackenzie was a child companion of Grace Betty, and she said when that question was asked, Grace didn't raise her hand and I didn't raise my hand. That all by itself guts the reasoning of the court, because there is a fact question about whether she reported the very thing upon which the judge relied. You will find that at document 25, the Moe affidavit, exhibit 1. Beyond that, there is a fact question about whether the warnings that the DNR provided were actually reasonable. Now, the warnings come in a couple of different places. First of all, there is this orientation session, and the evidence in the record, viewed in a light most favorable to the plaintiff, shows that it was hundreds of feet from the pond. In fact, you couldn't see the pond from the orientation area, according to one of the witnesses. And so when the naturalist is telling this group of young children about the dangers, they can't look at the pond and see what she's talking about. Moreover, there's evidence that the children really weren't paying attention. One of the witnesses says they were antsy, that they were eager to get out, that they really weren't paying attention. Finally, we have the sign that is prominently displayed in the addendum to the appellant's city's brief. We've reproduced it in our brief. And I think that sign is important for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's no evidence that Grace saw it or didn't see it. That may be a fact that is going to be developed through discovery, but it certainly isn't a fact that is alleged in the complaint. But more importantly, the DNR says in that warning that parents, do not leave your children alone. Children 7 and up have to be supervised by an adult with feet on the sand or in the water. Why is that? Because children don't appreciate the danger present at this particular pond. And it was dangerous.
Counsel, is it also germane to the lack of supervisory responsibility that the DNR has for the children in the pond? I mean,
this gets to the question that Judge Riley asked about the child trespasser statute. The reason this court and the Supreme Court have not in prior cases applied the child trespasser statute is the theory that children in state parks are not likely to be alone. That's the Sirik case. They are likely to be supervised by their parents. So we're going to apply an adult trespasser standard. But this case is different because there is evidence from which a jury could conclude that Grace was not supervised by an adult. In fact,
But how does that make the DNR responsible? I'm having trouble finding. I mean, number one, a negligent supervision claim was not pled in the complaint explicitly. So,
Your Honor, it goes to whether the DNR has acted under the adult child trespasser standard to protect the child. The child's conduct is measured the same way under either standard. The landowner's conduct is measured somewhat differently. Under the adult trespasser standard, the landowner simply has to warn. Under the child trespasser standard, the landowner has an affirmative duty to protect the child, which would be
our Supreme Court has been really clear that they don't, as a public policy, don't want the DNR to have to childproof every state park.
I understand that completely, Your Honor, but unique facts make the law apply somewhat differently. And on these facts, a jury could conclude that the DNR knew that the children weren't being supervised. One of the adults that was there went to the DNR and said, look, those chaperones are sitting up there at a picnic table on their cell phones. And the DNR then went over and chastised them for not doing what they were doing. That undercuts the whole premise that you apply the adult trespasser standard, not the child trespasser standard. But I don't want to get hung up in that too much, Your Honor, because you can reverse the district court based on the Section 335, the trespasser standard. And you can do that because of this. The adequacy of the warning is what gets immunity for the DNR. And there's a fact question about the adequacy of the warning. Now, the DNR has relied on a line of cases that say children, as a matter of law, know about the danger of water. And with respect, Your Honor, when the Supreme Court decided Sinoglis, it rejected that concept categorically. It said, no, that's not the law in Minnesota. Now, Sinoglis dealt with an invitee rather than a landowner, or rather than a trespasser. But the test of what the child knows is the same in both cases. And the Supreme Court could not be more clear. We declined to adopt a categorical rule that the danger of swimming unattended in any Minnesota river, lake, or pool is necessarily obvious to all children, no matter how young or inexperienced. And what they said is it's a fact question.
Yes, that gets to my question. You said it's a fact question. You've been saying that on a number of occasions.
Because it is.
The district court confined her analysis to a Rule 12 motion to dismiss. So what's in the complaint?
She said that, but she didn't do it, Your Honor. The one piece of evidence that she looked to about Grace Betty reporting she was a non-swimmer was the extrinsic evidence.
So do you think that we find that she was wrong and say that she converted it to a Rule 56? Or how do you think we should analyze?
Well, first of all, she was wrong. It's wrong to say that the complaint does not include a claim of failure on the part of the DNR to warn. I gave you the paragraphs before. Paragraph 18, there's a hidden danger. Paragraph 35, 36, 37, the failure of the DNR to warn of that danger. That gets then you to what does Grace Betty know? And that's a fact question. So the adequacy of the warning and the knowledge of the child are both fact questions. Now, if you analyze it on a Rule 12 standard, you have to draw every inference from the complaint in favor of the plaintiff. And you have to say, is there a set of facts which, if proven, would result in liability? Absolutely, that's true here. But if you go outside the facts of the complaint, which the judge did, then she has to consider all of the evidence. And that evidence includes evidence that the DNR knew the children weren't being supervised, weren't chaperoned, and that undercuts the whole rationale of the refusing to apply the child trespasser standard.
Counsel, can I just, I just want to clarify your position. If we found that the complaint stated the relevant elements so such that Section 335 applied, do we need to reach the question of whether the child trespasser exception applies as well?
I think you do not need to reach it, Your Honor. I think that you could. And I think that it may be an issue that once the facts are developed in the record, once there is some discovery, it could be revisited. Because as I said, the premise for applying the adult trespasser standard as opposed to the child trespasser standard is that children in public parks are likely to be with their parents. So as a matter of policy, we just say that's how it is. But when you have actual knowledge of the children not being supervised, and when a DNR employee goes to the chaperones and says, you're not watching these kids, and when you've got a sign that says, if you've got a kid out there, feet on the sand, feet in the water, there's a really strong argument that the child trespasser standard should apply. I see I'm at the end of my time. I will be happy to listen to the arguments of my colleagues and talk to you again in about 20 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bayless.
May it please the court, my name is Ken Bayless and I'm appearing on behalf of the city of Moorhead. We'd ask this court to reverse the trial court and grant the city's motion for dismissal. The court has raised the question of whether 339 or 335 would apply. This is a really important issue. And the reason it's really important is because of the procedural posture of this case, which it was decided on a Rule 12 motion. And if it was a 339 case, there's no way that should have been decided on a motion to dismiss. But it's a 335 case. And we know that because two decisions of the Minnesota Supreme Court, the Sirik case and then the Johnson case, both explicitly state that 335 applies. Then we have this court's decision in a child drowning case, Zacharias, specifically stating that 335 applies and saying that it had to come to that conclusion because the Sierra case and the Johnson case already said that. So there's simply no dispute. Sometimes courts will go in and discuss 339 because they'll say, well, even if we were to apply 339, it wouldn't matter. But the Supreme Court has said that in Sirik, Johnson, and this court in Zacharias, that it's 335. And the reason that's important to the procedural posture and the fact that this is a Rule 12 motion is 335 is an objective standard. So counsel has spent a lot of time talking about ordinary negligence and what Grace Beatty heard, what she knew, what her age was, and talking about those various factors that would go into talking about an ordinary negligence case. The standard here is the adult trespasser standard. It's not the Grace Betty standard.
But with all due respect, Mr. Bayless, the duty that the city owed to these children was supervisory in nature. It wasn't to maintain or the premises. I mean, we're not talking about a premises liability case here. We're talking about a dereliction of duty in supervising these children.
Well, the courts have stated that when we reach these immunity issues, we're beyond the question of duty and breach. And in Johnson, for instance, the court said, even if there was a duty and even if there was a breach, the immunity still applies. So it's kind of a paper covers rock analysis in the sense that if immunity applies, even if there was negligence, even if there was a duty, even if there was a breach of that duty, the negligence still applies. Or the immunity still applies to the situation,
so,
and precludes liability.
So essentially the city's claim is because you took the kids on a field trip to a park, they become immune from a dereliction of duty and their supervisory responsibilities.
Because
if they were back at the regular camp, they would not be immune.
Correct. Well, the key is the outdoor recreation immunity. Opposing counsel has argued, well, if they took them to Valley Fair or someplace like that, then they're saying they'd be immune. The answer to that is no, not unless Valley Fair was owned by the state of Minnesota. 3.736 immunity as found in 46603 subdivision 15, is designed to extend to the county and to the city and to municipalities all those immunities that are held by the state. And the state has immunity for losses caused to users of the outdoor recreation system. So it has immunity for conditions in the pond. And the state also has, importantly, immunity from supervisory claims that relate to those recreational activities at the pond.
What's the legal basis for that proposition?
Johnson says that the Johnson and Lloyd and the Schrammel case all state that the only liability is for the condition of the condition itself and not for supervisory activities. So if you look in Johnson,
that's for the DNR that maintains the property.
Right. And we're just saying,
but you're not maintaining the property.
Well, that's true, but that's why it's 3.736 like immunity is the title of it, and not 3.736 immunity, because the purpose of that immunity, the legislature stepped in and said, if there's any situation in which the state is immune, we want municipalities to be immune in that same situation. So if you've got somebody who has a loss at a state park, the state is immune. And if we have somebody that there's a loss at a state park, involving the city, we want that to be immune as well. That's the entire purpose of 3.736 like immunity. I'd point out, in direct contradiction to a statement that was made by counsel, that the issue was weighed below. It was never raised. It was never addressed. Now, counsel has said that it was addressed at page, 17 and 18 of the memorandum below. But if you look at those pages, all it says is that the state's immunity under 46603 subdivision 6E doesn't apply. And that was never argued. We never argued that 46603 subdivision 6E applied. We argued that 15 applied. And then in our reply brief below, we raised the issue that they've never addressed this issue and they've never contested this issue. And they still didn't reply. We have the transcript of the oral argument before the trial court, and they simply didn't raise the issue. I'd like to address one question, one fundamental question that further goes to this issue of why it is that this particular case was suitable for a Rule 12 motion. And that is because the conditions that are complained of aren't conditions that can give liability to give rise to liability under the restatement standard. And the reason I say that is,
Mr. this- Mr. Bayless, you're getting to what I think is the crux of the complaint, and I'll have this question for Ms. Miletich also, which is, what is the hidden danger? So if the hidden danger is like the pond constructed at Flandreau State Park, as in Zacharias, where the court said there weren't sudden drop-offs, it was a gradual deepening, unlike this. So is the hidden danger the pond? Because if it's the pond, I think it's clear where our case law is. But if it's the way that it was constructed so that there's this, I'll call it muddy water, and then this sudden drop off, is that the hidden danger? What do you think we should look to for defining what the hidden danger is vis-a-vis the trespasser restatement?
Well, below, the plaintiff respondent came forward with two answers to why there was some type of hidden danger. And the first is the water was cloudy. Well, if the water's cloudy, that's not hidden. It's, you're saying when you look at the water, it is cloudy. That's not a hidden condition. As far as the drop-off is concerned, the plaintiff actually conceded below that all the children were told about the existence of the drop-off. So at page 8 and 9 of the transcript, This is a quote. If you would take a look, for instance, at the first factor of the drop-off, obviously the DNR was aware. We know this because a naturalist, Ms. Kimote, told the children there was a drop-off in the pond. So they conceded at oral argument on this motion that there was actually a warning. And under this restatement standard, whether hidden or not, your only obligation is to warn. So the court makes a good point about hidden. But I want to make one more point about these conditions, and that is that they're not the type of artificial condition that can give rise to liability in any event under the restatement standard. If you look at the Martin v. Spirit Mountain case, you see that conditions that duplicate natural conditions cannot give rise to liability. This is what the Minnesota Supreme Court said. So they had a ski hill, and there was a slope on the ski hill, and somebody said, well, that was made by a bulldozer. It wasn't made by nature. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said that doesn't matter. In this case, we have a pond, and the pond has, you know, ponds in Minnesota in their natural condition are of various levels of cloudiness, and there are various levels of slope. They vary widely. And those are not artificial conditions. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that is what we said in the Johnson case. So if you look at the Martin case at page 722, the Minnesota Supreme Court says just that conditions that are duplicative of natural conditions do not give rise to liability under the restatement standard. So the fact that in this instance, we have a slope and we have cloudiness, things you'd find in nature, even if they had not been conceded below, and even if cloudy water is invisible, those still are not artificial conditions that can give rise to liability under the restatement standard.
But in Johnson, the court noted that it was free, the artificially created swimming pond was free from traps or concealments, and there were no drop-offs.
Right. In this case, there was an admission that there was a warning given with respect to the drop-off. So that's a non-issue as conceded at oral argument below. I see my time is running pretty low here. Does the court have any additional questions?
Judge Flory, Judge Frisch?
Okay, we'd ask that you reverse the decision with respect to the city and grant its motion.
Thank you. And now, attorney for the DNR.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Cicely Miltich, and I'm an assistant attorney general appearing here today on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. This case involves the straightforward application of recreational use immunity. The facts of this case are undisputedly tragic, but unfortunately they are not unique. Given the inherent dangers of swimming, this is by no means the first case involving a drowning at a public property to come before the Minnesota appellate courts. In each of them, the courts have found government entities entitled to recreational use immunity as a matter of law, and the district court was correct in finding the same applied here. I'd like to focus my time on two issues here today. The first is that the complaint was properly dismissed because the crux of plaintiff's claim is negligent supervision, which DNR is absolutely entitled to immunity from without consideration of the trespasser exception. And second, I'd like to address the two elements of the trespasser exception that plaintiff cannot establish here, whether viewed just as the complaint under Rule 12 standard, or whether the court looks to the extrinsic evidence that plaintiffs submitted under Rule 56, and that's that the dangers of the pond.
So that gets to my question that I have for you, Ms. Miltich. Is it the DNR's position that we should be analyzing this case solely as a Rule 12 dismissal on the four corners of the complaint and the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from that? Or do you take the position that we should convert the matter to a Rule 56 motion because the judge arguably went outside the four corners of the complaint?
Your Honor, I think this case can be decided at the Rule 12 standard, which is why DNR moved on that basis. But if this court does determine, based on the language of the district court's order, that it went outside, I think it is absolutely proper for this court to review it as a summary judgment motion, as the court has done before, for example, in the Defenders of Wildlife versus Ventura matter. Plaintiff put in all of the extrinsic evidence that she indicated would be necessary in order for a summary judgment motion to be decided. The court has all of those same materials before it, and I think all parties have fully briefed both the motion to dismiss standard as well as the motion for summary judgment. So there would be no benefit to remanding to the district court for consideration of that.
So you take the position then that the parties, and particularly the DNR and the city here, have had an adequate opportunity to develop the record to address a Rule 56 motion as opposed to a Rule 12 motion? I'm just looking at this from a fairness standpoint. Everybody's addressed this as a Rule 12 motion, but you're not claiming any prejudice then if we were to say, okay, fine, we'll look at this as a Rule 56 motion and no one's been prejudiced because they haven't been given an opportunity to develop the record through discovery.
Your Honor, I don't believe that additional discovery is necessary. I would note here that plaintiff didn't affirmatively move for summary judgment. So I think the fairness in terms of review would be reviewing whether DNR is entitled to summary judgment on this record.
Which elements of Section 335 were not adequately pled in the complaint?
That the dangers of the pond at the state park were hidden or non-obvious, and that DNR failed to warn about any dangers of the pond.
So as to the former, I mean, there is an allegation in the complaint that there is a steep drop off and it was concealed, right?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. Our position is that the relevant, and this goes to Judge Riley's question to Mr. Bayless, that the relevant consideration is the dangerous condition of the pond itself. And that's consistent with the allegations in the complaint, for example, at paragraph 115 in the actual negligence count against DNR, plaintiff alleges that DNR knew or should have known that permitting Grace to swim in the pond could create a dangerous condition. So the dangerous condition that's being alleged there is the pond itself.
Well, being allowed to swim in a pond that contains a steep drop off that was concealed by murky water. I mean, it's all of the conditions on the land, not just the one that you can see from standing on the shore, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But the Minnesota case law has not parsed out. There are many elements of bodies of water that can be dangerous. For example, there could be, you know, slippery rocks at the bottom of a lake. There could be an artificial pond that's particularly cold at certain times of year or that's susceptible to algae blooms. And what Minnesota courts have said in the Zacharias case from this court, as well as the Bredvik versus City of Morris case from this court, in Zacharias, the court focused, plaintiff there also made allegations, for example, that the water was murky and that there was a deep portion of the pond. And the court itself defined the dangerous condition as being the water itself and noted DNR, quote, had no duty to warn of drowning in the pond. And that's at page 320 of Zacharias. In Bredvik, the plaintiff made similar allegations about the murkiness of the water contributing to dangerousness. And the court there said that, quote, the nature of water remains the same, and water is always a potential cause of drowning, regardless of whether it's cloudy. The dangerous condition that caused the harm to the plaintiff in those cases and here is the pond. And certainly there's no allegation in the complaint that that was hidden or non-obvious. But then even if you look specifically to the conditions of the deep water, this is where we get into the allegation in the complaint that when asked at the safety presentation whether she was a non-swimmer, that's when the child identified as a non-swimmer and someone who was uncomfortable swimming in water over her head.
So the question, so then, you know, that does bring me to the second point that you make, and that is the adequacy of the warning that the DNR provided. And I question whether that is a question of fact that needs to be resolved in this case, because in light of the conditions of the pond, which are not normal conditions, they are challenging conditions. I mean, given the number of children that were in the pond, given the amount of silt that was kicked up from the swimming and the overcrowding in the pond and the steep drop off, and whether it was concealed, whether the adequacy of the warning to a child, whether that presents a question for a resolution by a jury as opposed to by a judge based on the pleadings.
And it does not, Your Honor, present a question of fact. And that's because this is an objective test. The adequacy of the warning is tested as under an objective standard that's set forth in the Leshinsky versus City of Duluth case.
Objective to the recipient of the warning?
Objective under the adult trespasser standard. So no, it does not depend on whether the individual saw it. For example, there's no requirement that the adequacy of the warning be directed to, for example, a user of a state park who may have poor vision. DNR is not subjected to a different standard under 335 for that particular plaintiff.
Did the warning identify where the drop-off was in the pond?
Yes, Your Honor. The extrinsic evidence that was submitted by plaintiff shows that there were buoys actually placed on the water demarcating the deep areas. That's at document 27, exhibit E, and also in the addendum at page A9. There were also warning sign. The warning sign that was placed on the back of the lifeguard station also had a map of the lake that reflected the depth chart. And then during the safety presentation, the interview of the safety presentation is at document 25, exhibit F. And there the DNR employee who provided the safety presentation described how she used her hands to demonstrate that the depth of the pond, you know, changed quickly at that drop-off point. And plaintiff simply hasn't identified any case law here that suggests that Minnesota courts parse warnings at the level that they are suggesting. A warning could always be bigger or brighter or be delivered to someone who is paying more or more attention. That's not the relevant duty. The duty is whether the warning has been provided and whether it objectively warns of the conditions. And here there's nothing to dispute that both the murkiness and the deep area of the pond were amply discussed both in spoken form, written form, as well as the actual buoys in the water. I see that my time is set to expire, so if there are no other questions from the court, I will rest on the briefs.
Judge Flory, I see Judge Frisch shaking her head no, and you also. Then Mr. Magnuson, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Was the warning ample? Immediately after it was given, adults there saw the children breaking the rules, not paying any attention, ignoring what they had just been told. Fact question as to whether they were adequately warned. Rule 12, the judge based it on the fact that Grace raised her hand. That's an extrinsic fact. She can't do that and not convert it to summary judgment. And if it's a summary judgment motion, there's no way that the DNR and the city get summary judgment because of all the fact issues. And the fact issues include, was the warning adequate? And did Grace appreciate the dangers? That's the test. Now, Your Honor, whether this is an artificial condition, Exhibit A to the Moe affidavit, which is document 25, is a report from the Minnesota Department of Health analyzing swimming ponds, including Buffalo Lake State Park. And at pages 6 and 7 of that report, they talk about the visibility issue. And at page 7, the DNR says, these ponds are different. You've got to make a clay bottom, and they tend to get really cloudy. And the Minnesota Department of Health report at page 7 says that this presents a greater health risk than a normal pond. You'll find that right there. And is it a greater risk? It reports that there's one prior drowning as of the date of that report. There are two more prior drownings and near drownings that the DNR is supposed to know about. So if this is a condition that isn't hidden and doesn't present a risk to children, you've got a lot of kids drowning or nearly drowning. Sirik, Johnson, Zacharias, no sudden drop off. Whether the warning is reasonable, yes, it has an objective element. But the question is whether Grace Betty appreciated the danger of not being able to see where the drop-off was. And there's no clear evidence in this record as to how close to the buoys the drop-off was. It's not whether if she put 1 foot beyond it, she's suddenly going down 3 feet or not. That's the kind of thing you develop on discovery. I didn't hear counsel talk about Sinoglis at all. And I don't know how you can look at this case and not talk about it, because the Supreme Court said absolutely, unequivocally, whether a child appreciates the danger of water, the particular danger to which they are exposed is a fact question. You can't, and it said, there are all sorts of drowning cases that the Court of Appeals has talked about where they say, nope, as a matter of law, children of a certain age appreciate the danger. And it says, this is footnote 9 of the opinion. It says, we reject that. We reject that premise. So you have to go there. Your Honor, whether there is negligent supervision goes to two different points. It goes to the 339 standard of the duty to protect a child. Once the DNR knew these kids weren't supervised, and there is evidence from which a jury could conclude that. But it also goes to the adequacy of the warning. They gave a warning and they knew the children weren't following it. Now, we could lose this case in front of a jury. A jury could say, ah, come on, everybody knows what this danger is. And these children were given plenty of notice. But that's not the test. Rule 12, we get the benefit of every inference in favor of our client. And the question is, could you prove a set of facts that would impose liability based on the allegations? Absolutely could. There are cases, and we cited them, Habeck and a bunch of other cases, where immunity is denied as a fact question. And then under Rule 56, all of the evidence shows a chaotic environment with an uncertain warning, and the DNR knows it's not working, and they go admonish the chaperones that they're not doing their job. When they have a sign up that says, don't leave your children alone, even if they're more than 7 years old, feet on the sand or in the water. This case should not be decided summarily. You should reverse, you should remand for further proceedings. Thank you very much.
Thank you to all counsel. The case was well briefed and well argued, and we will have our decision out within 90 days.